welcome to Nice to Know. I'm Robin Schenk, and this is the podcast where I talk to everyday scientists. I find out what they know and what it's like to be a scientist. This week, I'm talking with Rhiannon Morris, or should I say Dr. Rhiannon Morris, as she just finished her PhD last week, so congratulations. So Rhiannon completed her PhD in the lab of Jeff Babin at the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute, otherwise known as WEHI, in Melbourne, Australia. This is where I also did my PhD, so I know Rhiannon from my time at WEHI. Rhiannon is a biochemist and she studies structural biology, which in my mind is like the kind of weirdest name for a area of biology, because it's like, well, like, what is a biological structure? What does that even mean? And basically what it means is that she studies proteins and what they look like, so what their structure is. And of course, by protein, I mean the molecules that like do everything in the cell. Rhiannon likens them to the worker bees of the cell. You know, they carry out all kinds of functions to enable cells to grow, divide, move, etc. Anyways, Rhiannon is also, like me, really interested in science communication, and she does this through her Twitter and Instagram channels. And through these channels, one of her main aims is to show that scientists are like normal people. And also she discusses what it's like to do a PhD. So naturally, today's discussion kind of goes in that direction. We talk about some of the challenges and rewards of doing a PhD. Anyways, I think it's a really cool chat, you know, a bit of structural biology, a bit of just general what it's like to be a PhD student, and I hope you enjoy. All right, so hello and welcome to Nice to Know. Today I'm joined by my friend Rhiannon Morris. She's joining me from Australia. She is a PhD student, or should I say PhD candidate? I don't know which term you prefer.
Does not matter to me what you're called, it's fine.
The reason I say this is because I was looking up, like stalking you on Twitter and the internet and stuff, and you choose the word PhD candidate, which is either an Australian thing or it's like, because I also know on Twitter you have a lot of these conversations about how people are like, oh, so you're still a student? Do you just enjoy studying forever? And you're like, no, it's not like that.
That is exactly why I use the word candidate. Sometimes I even say doctoral candidate because it does completely takes away all connotations of like everything to do with student. But yeah.
Yeah. Anyways, Rhiannon, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me. It's really exciting.
Yeah, well, I hope so. So, first question for you. What kind of scientist would you describe yourself as?
So, I tell people that I am a biochemist and I use biochemical techniques to study the proteins in our cells, which are like the little machines doing things, and how when they don't do the right things, we get blood cancer.
Okay. Cool. I wanted to ask that because, so one, biochemistry, how would you define biochemistry? Because it's a bit of a weird term. And the second thing, actually, because I know that you're also a structural biologist, and I wanted to know whether you ever tell anyone, yeah, I'm a structural biologist, or I do crystallography, and like what kind of reaction you get to those words as well.
Yeah, the reason I use the word biochemist is because when I say structural biologist, and even trying to explain that is really hard. So like in terms of the biochemistry side of things, it's really just studying like living molecules, the things inside our cells, DNA, RNA. I only study proteins, but all those things are kind of encompassed. And yeah, I do structural biology, and just I still haven't worked out a way to really explain to people, like my mum, for example, what a protein structure is and why it's important, and like what I'd like explaining x-ray crystallography to people when you barely understand it is like a whole nother level. So it's a tricky one. And explaining that proteins form crystals is a whole like extra level of confusion on top of that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, do you want to have a crack at it now? Like, what would your lay explanation of structural biology be?
Yeah, I can try. So I guess this is the thing. You have to kind of have an understanding of what a protein is. And I think a lot of the time, people who've never had a science background, they'll be like, protein powder. Like, they're not wrong.
Yeah.
But the things that make up the protein powder are the proteins and what they actually are. Like, that's why I say, like, little machines inside our cells. but just like a machine in a factory would look like something like you would recognize it and be like, that's the machine that's like squirting sauce into a bottle and this one is the one that's packaging it. They have structures, they're built some way, and the proteins inside our cells are also built some way, and we want to understand what they look like so we can do things like design drugs against them or understand how two proteins might interact with one another, which is what I do.
Yeah, that's actually a really great analogy of like machines in the factory that do a certain job. And of course, they have like a physical presence. It's just like on a really atomic scale, I guess, is the thing. And you can even like, if anyone's interested, you can go on the internet and look up what a protein structure actually looks like. And you'll see these crazy like curly ribbons and stuff. But that's literally what the proteins in our cells look like. And the way that their shapes are made, as you say, determines what interactions they might have with other proteins, literally in like this lock and key fashion. So it's kind of crazy because it's all just on this like teeny tiny scale that you can't see with the naked eye. But I guess also to help you out with your description of like what X-ray crystallography and blah blah blah, it's just a technique to be able to see these things in a nutshell, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like it's, I try and use, so two of the main techniques in structural biology are NMR and X-ray crystallography. So NMR is like having an MRI for your brain or something else in your body, but on a really, really, really small scale. It's like still using that same technique of like the methods of the magnets and all that type of stuff. And then X-ray crystallography is like if you break a bone and you need an X-ray, like the same type of thing, not quite the same wavelength. You don't want to be putting your arm in front of the X-ray beam that we use for crystals. But yeah, it's still an X-ray. It does the same thing, yeah.
And so how have you applied these methods to the problem of your PhD, or like what has your PhD been trying to understand?
Yeah, so really specifically, I study how the proteins in a pathway that's really important for the development of our blood cells called the JAK-STAT pathway. There's very few components of the pathway, but the things that negatively regulate that pathway, understanding how one protein, which is called JAK, that's where the JAK-STAT pathway gets its name, is regulated by another protein, how they interact with one another in, how you said, this like lock and key kind of fashion. They recognize one another. And so we can use structural biology to solve the structure of that negative regulator binding to another protein. And then we can say, okay, it's binding here, and now we understand how they're interacting. And now we can understand that if one of these is mutated, that interaction is now lost and everything falls apart.
And so this is a mutation that you see in some kinds of blood cancer?
Yeah, so a really good example of that is diseases called the myeloproliferative neoplasms, which are just like your cells are overproliferating. It's like a type of cancer. And the most common cause of that is a mutation in JAK called V617F, which is just changing one amino acid in the protein to a different amino acid, and it just throws everything out of balance. And that's something that we still really don't understand. And we're trying to use structural biology to learn that and like what change happens in that protein when one amino acid is changed, and why does it suddenly like become completely out of control? It tends to be something that people don't find out that they have until in their 60s, and they start having just general issues, and then they go to the doctor and they're like, oh, we're not quite sure, and they screen for various things, and then they will like sequence their DNA and be like, oh yeah, you have this mutation. So most people don't know. Although recently someone on Twitter like messaged me and was like, hey, I have this mutation. And I was like, wow, how old are you? And she was like, I'm in my 30s. And I was like, how did you find out? It was crazy. That's really rare. So yeah.
Interesting. On that note, so you have a really massive following on Twitter, and I gather this is largely stemmed from, because also you run this blog, which is basically science communication, talking about your life as a PhD student, what you're studying. Can you explain a little bit like how you started that? And I mean, because as I said, it's gotten you, you've done so well with it. So it's really interesting to see how did that begin?
Yeah, that's a good question, actually. I had Twitter for a really long time, and when I was an undergrad, I actually just started like looking at people's tweets and just chatting to people from all around the world. And I actually found, I was like, wow, this is a really useful tool. Like I would never be able to interact with these people without like this social networking tool. And I was actually able to go to Boston after my final year of undergrad and meet a lot of people, which was incredible to me. And I also got the opportunity to go to WEHI because of Twitter. Like, that's how I learned about WEHI. And I ended up in Doug's lab, the director, through, like, meeting him through Twitter. And I think the way that things really blew up in terms of the science communication side of things for me is when I did honours, when I moved to Melbourne, I wanted to read a paper a day for a year.
Oh my God.
which I did. I don't recommend it. It was stupid. I say to people all the time, like, you're much better reading a paper a month or a week, a paper a day. You don't remember anything. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting because I tried to do it during this isolation period. I was like, I'm going to do a paper a day. Admittedly, I did it for like 30 days and I was tweeting about it more like for my own accountability than anything else. But after a while, I was just like, oh, yeah, I'm not sure I'm like remembering any of it. But either way, I read more papers than I normally would in a year. So that was kind of good. Sorry, I digress.
No, that's like, I saw that you were doing that. And that's exactly why I did it. Because I was an undergrad and I was like, I need to learn how to do this at some point. So I'm going to force myself to do it. And like you said, I used it like as an accountability thing. But so many people like saw me doing it and started following me. And I was like, wow, this is actually like, if you can get a pretty good following if you talk about science and like being excited about science, and things just kind of progress from there. So I now have an Instagram where I talk about science a lot and kind of try and, I think my goal is just to show people that scientists are just like everyone else.
Yes. That's what I'm trying to do as well.
Yeah, I love that. That's why I love this idea, because like people still think of scientists as like old people in dungeons and stuff, and it's like, we're not. We're really not. Yeah.
I also particularly like on your Instagram that you go through the different like kind of lab techniques that you use and you explain them in a kind of simple way. I think it's a really great resource for particularly like undergrad students looking into doing their PhD and that kind of thing. So yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I feel like this is a thing that I've been like thinking about a lot recently, because I did start all of this to kind of show other people that scientists are just like them and kind of increase the public's trust in things. But the majority of people who follow me both on Twitter and Instagram are scientists or science students. So it was kind of like, okay, well, what's another way I can help? So I obviously now I talk a lot about techniques in the lab and that type of stuff, which is helpful for everyone. But I also like give little insights into what it's really like to do a PhD, not only just for people who might be viewing my profile as a non-scientist, but also people who are like, maybe I want to do a PhD. So they get a better idea of kind of what it's really like.
Actually, that makes me think of like a bonus question for you. So now that you're coming to the end of your PhD, I know you're very close to submitting. What would be, say, like the top three things that you have learned during your PhD?
Oh my goodness. Such a hard question. I feel like I'm going to throw this back at you afterwards and ask you the same things.
Yeah, sure. I'll have a minute to prepare because I asked you first, but...
You can tell me whether you agree with me as well. So, like, I think the biggest thing that I've learned is, and this is really weird because it's, like, very specifically a scientist thing, but as you know, a lot of things in the lab fail. And when I started, I tied all my self-worth to my experiments and how things were going in the lab and how things were progressing. And I've really had to learn that when things go wrong, they're not always your fault. It doesn't reflect badly on you as a person. Just because your experiment didn't work doesn't make you a terrible, terrible scientist and a terrible, terrible person. And I just had to like really separate my identity from me as a scientist, because I was like, I'm a scientist, I'm a PhD student. When things go wrong, like my whole world blows up. So I really had to learn that the hard way. Yeah, that's a good one.
I think a lot of people, especially because you generally get people entering into PhDs that are very high achievers, and sometimes they're not used to not having perfection or success all the time. So yeah, it can be a real hurdle, I guess.
Yeah, I feel like that's a really common thing that people struggle with. Like, it's really the first time they hit a wall. I'm the first person to tell people, like, I failed 3 out of 4 of my units in my first year of undergrad. So like I already hit my wall and learned that you have to get past those things. So I guess hitting a wall a second time was less of a like shock to the system for me, but a lot of people like find that so hard. And also, I do talk about this a lot, like you go through this system where you're given grades and you're rewarded for working hard, and then in a PhD the amount of work you put in doesn't necessarily equal what you get out, and you're like, oh, this is really confusing, like does not compute. So that's another thing I definitely had to learn, like not everything in life, if you give it 100%, are you going to get 100% out? Sometimes you're going to get 0% out. It's just how things work.
That's so true. So anything else that you've learned in your PhD?
What else have I learned? I think I've, like, one of the things I've learned is to be patient with myself and others. And I've also learned that collaboration, not only in terms of, like, it's good in terms of scientific progress, but you also need to collaborate with people. And, like, this is the thing about science. Like, people think that we're hiding the cure for cancer. Like, we're really not. Like, that's not a real thing. Like, we're all working towards this big purpose together, and collaboration will get you so much further than trying to work by yourself and, like, do dodgy things in the corner and, like, try and scoop other people and all of this. There's a lot of hard stuff in science, and I feel like a good community makes science better. That's one thing that I've learned, yeah.
Yeah, that's very true. Okay, so since I had a few minutes to think about my things, also I've been doing my postdoc for 2 years, and I don't know if this influences it because it's like even more hindsight and continuing to build off these things, but definitely number one is like perseverance. Which is kind of similar to what you said in terms of in the face of failure. Like now when an experiment goes wrong for me, it's almost like water off a duck's back, because I'm just like, it happened again.
You're like, I'm going home and I'll try again tomorrow.
Exactly. Like it doesn't get me down. And also my PhD was full of not negative results, but just like uninteresting results. Like where we had this hypothesis and we were wrong, and then we had another one and we were also wrong, and it was just like kept going, but I like never kind of gave up. Maybe that's because I'm too stubborn or something, but definitely perseverance number one. Number two, I've written down skills, because I think this is what I tell a lot of people. What a lot of people doing their PhD, I'm like, you never realize how much you're actually learning just by doing the PhD, like outside of what you're supposed to be learning about, if that makes any sense. Like you're studying a particular research question and blah, 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 but you're learning project management, you're learning communication, you're learning writing skills, how to think on your feet and this kind of thing. Like, in that sense, like, it doesn't matter if you continue in academia, or I have no qualms about, like, leaving academia potentially, also because, like, the job market is precarious, because I'm like, I have so many other skills, I'm gonna find a job somewhere doing something, because, yeah, of all the things that you've learned. And then the third one is also kind of related to yours, was, like, learning how to ask for help, or that it's totally okay to ask for help. Which is kind of in line with the collaboration thing, because you get so much further if you're just like, I do not know this, someone help, like, just, or even just to check, I'm like, I think this is a dumb idea, can you, like, confirm or, you know, deny that for me? So
I think that's another really big thing. I get asked on my Instagram a lot, like, just various questions from people. And I'm always saying to people, like, I honestly don't know. Like, I don't know. And I think because I'm doing a PhD, they're like, oh, this person is, like, really high in their field. Like, they just know everything. And, like, I'm like, I have to ask people for help all the time. And people are like, oh, I'm so sorry for bothering you. I'm like, no. We all have to ask for help, whether it's about our career, whether it's about, like, an idea. Help. That's a very good one, and I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that's definitely something I've learned as well, because at the start I was definitely like, I'm just gonna struggle and like swim through that riptide.
Especially because there's this fear, you're like, oh, they're gonna think I'm so stupid. And I still kind of preface things like, this is a stupid question, but da 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 da. But I still, you know, at the end of the day, I'm still asking it. And then it's also a relief when you realize, oh, that wasn't such a stupid question. So yeah, 9 times out of 10, I think it's the case.
Interesting you say that. I'm not sure if I'd like to hear your opinion on this. Every time I have a discussion with a fellow woman in science, they tend to think this a lot more of themselves. They're like, this is a stupid question. But I very, very rarely will hear a man be like, I have a stupid question. Or like, this might be a stupid question. They're like, this is the best question. Like, maybe I think we have a lot more like imposter syndrome and self-doubt. Like, not that men don't, but I feel like that really plays into it. Because I hear this a lot from fellow like women who are PhD students. They're like, oh, I don't ask questions in like seminars because it's stupid. And I'm like, just try, like, just do it. Yeah.
Yeah, I got this idea from, I don't know if you've ever listened to the podcast, The Guilty Feminist.
I haven't.
It's really good. But way back at the beginning when this podcast started, they basically began by giving themselves challenges to, I don't know how to put it, like challenge their feminism or something. Anyways, one of them was like not to apologize. And the host, Deborah Frances White, she always has this really great bit where she's like, you know, when you go into the boardroom and you have an idea that you want to present, it's never going to fly if you're like, so I maybe have this idea. It's not very great, but like, what do you, I don't know what you think. Oh, it's probably stupid. Like, no one's going to support you if you don't like support yourself. I mean, that's kind of a bit of an aside, I guess, from the thing, but it's, yeah, it's also, you just have to back yourself when you ask a question, be like, my question deserves to be heard or something like this. And it is more, it seems to be more common in women, although I do know some, I do know that guys also have imposter syndrome, but there does seem to be this tendency of self-doubt in women that's quite pervasive in society in general. So, yeah. Oh, that was a great tangent. So, to get back to your specific research, I always ask my guests, do they have a big kind of scientific research question that you would love to see answered?
I feel like I have the most boring cop-out answer, which is like a cure for cancer, obviously, which is stupid because obviously it's not one disease and there's like multiple cancers and cure is extremely difficult and treatment is obviously a lot better than that. I feel like that's why I went into the kind of work I did. But overall, it's really like, I do really basic research and I know it's really far away from actually being able to help anyone. But then you hear stories about venetoclax, which is obviously a drug that helps cancer and has very basic science roots.
Yeah, maybe you could briefly explain the venetoclax story and how structural biology specifically helped with the design of that drug.
Yeah, sure. So it's hard to know how much detail to give with the whole story. Obviously, you know a lot about it as well. So venetoclax is a drug that we use to treat CLL in some people who have a disease that can't be treated by other therapy.
And just to interrupt briefly, CLL is a type of leukemia, right? Or is it chronic lymphocytic leukemia? Yeah.
Good pull off on that one. Yeah. And it specifically binds to a protein in our cells called BCL2, which is upregulated specifically in this type of cancer. So it's really specific for CLL. And part of designing that drug was to solve the structure of the BCL2 protein just by itself and then with the drug, and then they were able to tweak bits of the drug to get a high affinity interaction because there are other proteins that are very similar to this one and other drugs previous to this version would also bind to that one. So using structural biology, they can make a higher affinity molecule, which is obviously what has gone through clinical trials and now treats people. So yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's the best example that I mean, maybe we're biased because it came from Weihai and we both were at Weihai, but it's a really great example of how structural biology can be used. Like when you have a protein that you know is doing something specifically in cancer, and then you can use the structure of that molecule to think about how you can, as you say, inhibit or modulate its activity, and that is basically the drug that you have. So, and do you think that that's your long-term goal, to continue using structural biology in the context of cancer research?
Yeah, I've had to think about this a lot. Obviously, finishing my PhD, I have to find something to do with myself once this is all over. I really want to stay in the area of blood cancer. I'm really interested in hematology, particularly in malignant hematology, blood cancers. I just really love it. And obviously, it's a devastating disease for people as well. And it'd be great to find as many treatments or cures as we possibly can. In terms of using structural biology, I'm unsure, really. I am. Like, I've loved doing it in my PhD, but part of me is like, there's a lot of other great science that's been done. I could bring it to the table in a different way, or maybe I could learn new techniques. And there's a lot of avenues to possibly explore there, and I'm so confused about which ones to take. There's a lot of great science going on out there. Yeah.
And do you think you will, I guess it's difficult to say in the times of COVID-19, but are you thinking of going overseas for that?
Yeah, so another great question. At the moment, I'm staying in Melbourne just for a little bit, so that's where I'm based, obviously. I was hoping to get a postdoc in Melbourne to start with, and maybe try out some different techniques here. So I'm not even from Melbourne, so this is already away from home technically for me, but I've obviously put down my roots here, and then make a better decision about where I want to go based on that. So like you said, like, do I still want to do structural biology, or would I, are there other types of science that I'm happy to follow? And I think that will probably be a decider about where I want to go. So for example, LMB in Cambridge is like an amazing place to do structural biology, and I would love to work there, but they don't really do the type of research that I would be looking into, so I'd probably have to change fields. Or would I prefer to stay in the blood cancer field and change techniques? Yeah, so I am looking to go overseas eventually, but I think I have a lot of soul searching in terms of science to do here still. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting as well, because I can very much relate to you. When I went into doing my PhD, I had this real big, I mean, I even used to say to people, like, I'm going to go cure cancer. Like, that is my dream. And even moving into, I still remember, so when I interviewed for the lab that I now work for, my boss asked me, he's like, so why are you here? And I was like, oh, I saw you gave this really great seminar about leukemia or lymphoma, and it was really great, and I'm interested in that, blah, blah, blah. And he was like, well, I'm done with working on cancer. That was like literally the first sentence that we had of our interaction. And I was sitting there, I was like, well, but then I spent the rest of the day like getting to know the lab and seeing the other kind of research that they do. So we're an immunology lab. So, you know, very much hand in hand with blood cancers and that kind of thing, because these are cancers of your white blood cells and, you know, that's your immune system. And actually, it has surprised me how much I have enjoyed changing into this field, even though I worked in the cancer field before. And I've even become like somewhat disenchanted with the cancer field, because I feel like a lot of research these days is like in clinical trials and more, what's the word? It's less basic research, if you know what I mean. Like, the thing that got me really interested in cancer research was understanding how a cell should function normally, and then how cancer breaks the rules. And then somehow by learning how it breaks the rules, you can figure out what the normal state should be. And so now I guess I'm doing it the other way around. It's like learning what the normal state should be, which of course is always applicable to cancer if it goes wrong. But yeah, I've definitely moved away from that research. So maybe the same thing will happen for you. I don't know. It's a possibility.
I think when you finish a PhD as well, you spent so long working on this one thing and you're like, I'm so tied to this research. And so the thought of kind of changing is like, unless you're one of those people who are like, I didn't enjoy this at all. So, but I also have worked in so many different labs before I was working in this field, and I loved that research as well. So I know that I probably could move field and be very happy with it. And there's so much cool science going on, like, there's no need to limit yourself either, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. If anything, it's sometimes it's also like there's just too much choice. So you just have to go with your gut, I think, when it comes to choosing whatever your next step in research is, to be honest. But yeah.
Yeah, very true.
Cool. So I'm going to move on now to my two questions that I always ask my guests. Number one is, what is your favorite thing about being a scientist?
My favorite thing is, this is really selfish, but that's fine, I guess. It's learning. I really love learning, and in my PhD I have been able to learn about things that potentially no one else in the world knows about yet, especially in structural biology. some of the proteins that we saw the structure of, no one has ever seen the structure. And so, like, it blows my mind that I was the first person to solve a structure of something and, like, see that. Although it, like, looks like other proteins, but at the same time, like, wow, like, I did that. I learned something. Like, I'm improving the world, if it is at all. But yeah, that's my favorite part. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's cool. And then what would your least favorite thing be?
I think my least favorite thing is that it is very competitive, and I think that does drive some people to do the wrong thing. Not only is it competitive with funding, but it's competitive with publishing, and a lot of people will cut corners and do bad things and things that they shouldn't be doing to get ahead. And, like, that's not fair. It's not fair on other scientists, and it's not fair on the public who are funding them, and it's just the wrong thing to do, and it definitely gives the rest of us a really bad rap as well.
Do you mean in terms of, like, fabricating results, or?
Yeah, things like fabricating results, or, like, just kind of, or, like, the example I said earlier of collaborating with people, like going to a conference and perhaps finding out that someone else is working on the same thing as you, and instead of saying, like, oh, we should collaborate together, like calling up someone and being like, we need to fast track our work to, like, get in before them and that type of stuff, like, which is not necessarily as dodgy as fabricating data, obviously. That's really bad. Also, the other thing that really does my head in is people who use their title of PhD or MD or DO or whatever it is to promote anti-scientific bullcrap, like Dr. Oz or Dr. Phil. Like, don't do it. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you must see so much of that in the Twitter sphere as well. You mentioned before sometimes people messaging you. Do you often get these messages where people are like, is this real? Like, I read this on blah, 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 and so on.
Yeah, I get a lot of really weird messages, actually. People would be quite shocked. But I actually get a lot of messages from people who I can tell are quite vulnerable, and especially in this time now with COVID and stuff. And they're asking me things like, can this, like, red light cure cancer or cure COVID? And I'm like, no, it can't. Like, don't buy into that stuff. And someone's lying to you. Or people who think that vaccination for COVID-19 is, like, crowd control. And I'm like, no.
But I guess it's kind of encouraging that people are asking you, like, in that sense that they have some sort of faith in what you are doing based on your social media presence, and that you have the opportunity to not set them straight, so to speak, but, like, point them in the right direction, especially if you know the answer. For example, no, don't go injecting bleach, seriously, unless you're the president of the United States. Or alternatively, you know, just being like, I don't have the full answer here, but, you know, this is what I do know based on. I mean, I've had this as well. Every time I tell people that I'm an immunologist, they're like, oh, so you must know blah, blah, blah. And I do know a bit in terms of, like, I know a lot about antibody responses and how the immune system works. I don't know so much about virology itself, or, like, you know, how viruses behave. And a lot of people are talking about, will we be long-term immune? You know, we have to get flu vaccinations every year. And I'm like, yeah, but we don't, like, influenza is a very different virus to coronaviruses. And I don't know enough about, like, how they are different to, you know, make a good enough guess about how we will be immune to them in the future. But anyways, I try to put people on, like, a right-ish track and just admit, like, this is what I don't know, but what I definitely do know is whatever you're reading is wrong.
Yeah, I will say I definitely get some messages from people who are just like, they've gone off the edge and there's no coming back. But when people have read something and they want someone to sort of quickly fact check it, I'm like, thank you for actually reaching out to a scientist instead of to Frank on Facebook. Like, that's good. Like, you've done the right thing there. And if that's the thing, like you said, asking for help, if it's out of your depth, like, there's nothing wrong with asking something, and it's going to be out of my depth half the time as well. But at least, like, I have a bit of knowledge, even I could open a paper and be like, no, that's wrong.
Yeah. And use that kind of, like, critical mind to it. So, yeah, I think it's really good that people do ask you, even if it does mean you get, I don't know how many messages you get a day, actually.
I don't get that many, actually. I tend to post relatively harmless stuff in term at the moment. This is another thing. I'm a structural biologist and I work on like blood cancer and hematopoiesis. I'm not a COVID expert, and a lot of people have asked me to weigh in on this, and I've been like, no, it's not my area of expertise, so I'm just not going to. So I've been posting a lot of just about like jokes about writing a thesis. So usually my DMs are just full of laughing messages and people being like, you can do it. And I'm like, thank you.
And true, that is much needed when you are writing your thesis, I think.
It's very true.
Well, let's wrap it up then, because I think we've had a really great discussion. So I mentioned before that Rhiannon has her own blog. You can find that is rhiannonmorris.net. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
And spelling Rhiannon, maybe I'll get you to do it actually in case I mess it up.
I'll probably mess it up as well. It's R-H-I-A-N-N-O-N. And then Morris is M-O-R-R-I-S. Yep.
Awesome. And then also, how can people find you on Twitter and Instagram?
Scientist_Re, which is R-H-I, on my Instagram. And then it's also the same on Twitter. That was good of me. That was nice of me to make them the same. Nice and easy.
Sweet. Cool. Yeah, I highly recommend following, especially if you're interested in what she posts about like being a scientist and also the kind of techniques and stuff we do. And if you're just interested in structural biology and biochemistry and blood cancers and other stuff, would you say that's a good blurb? I don't know.
Sounds good to me. That's about what I speak about, being a scientist, structural biology, all that stuff. Yep.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for joining me this evening/morning, you know, time zones and all that. But yeah, it was really great. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
So that's it for Nice to Know this week. Thank you so much again for listening. I want to give a particular shout out to Elsdorf in Germany. Apparently I have two, maybe one person downloading it twice, I'm not sure, who downloads the episode every week or every 2 weeks before I have tweeted about it. So as far as I'm concerned, you may well be my number one fan, and I would love to know who you are, because I don't even know where Elsdorf is, let alone who lives there. So feel free to reach out. You can always find me through Twitter at Robin Sciences. That's Robin with a Y and the plural of science. Or you can email nicetoknowthepodcast@gmail.com. As I said, that's it for this week, and tune in 2 weeks' time for the next episode.